From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the program, the head of MV Transportation on why he thinks his company should run Milwaukee County Transit, why some politicians are holding their town hall meetings over the phone, the Wisconsin Humane Society works on animal welfare in impoverished areas.
Wherever there is human suffering, there is animal suffering. The same kinds of causes and dynamics and forces that challenge our communities where people live also challenge the animals in those communities.
A Marquette program gives international students a taste of regular American life.
One of the things the students have told me is most meaningful to them is just being able to come to an American home and have a meal. So pretty simple.
And a preview of Doors Open Milwaukee. Lake Effect is next after this news update. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for being with us today. The Milwaukee County Board of Supervisors will soon take up a proposed contract with MV Transportation to run the county's transit system. The Dallas-based company emerged as the winning bidder, though little has been publicly disclosed about the process. If the deal is finalized, the for-profit company would replace the nonprofit Milwaukee Transport Services, which has operated the transit system since 1975. We'll hear from various people interested in how the situation plays out in future days. Today, though, we're joined by MV Transportation CEO Carter Pate. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Mitch. Glad to be here.
How much different would you envision life would be for riders, for drivers, and for the other staff at Milwaukee County Transit if your contract is approved and MV takes over operations?
I think that they will notice the change almost overnight. We're sticklers about clean buses. And I noticed that, you know, almost the first time I showed up in town. Safety is huge with us, not only for the passengers as well as the drivers. We think that actually helps increase ridership when people view that as a safe haven to get to work, come home from work. And certainly the drivers I'm most concerned about, they need a safe environment to operate in. I think the technology that we have will blow a lot of people away. We have a lot of vision for apps where people can pull up their iPhone or Android. And instead of calling, where's my bus, you'll just pull it up on your iPhone and you can see your bus approaching the stop or look at the schedule. I think you'll see changes in re-diverting resources. We're one of the largest fuel hedgers, one of the largest fuel poolers. We have centralized buying for over $1 billion in revenue that we do. That gives us buying power that we can plow right back into the system. There's been a lot of service cuts as I've been doing my homework, and I think we've got to take a long, hard look at that in ridership. We've got to have more hours in the evenings. Not everybody works a first shift or a 9-to-5 job. And I think we have to take a long, hard look. Is this service really delivering the power to the people that need it the most to get to work or get home or for going to events? I think they'll also see tying in with rail down to Chicago or other communities where there's actually some thoughtful approach about when does the bus actually run and does the schedule match up together with other sources of transportation. So those would be some of the initial thoughts. I think people would readily see it almost from day one.
And so presumably as you approached this bid to do this, you studied and looked for this is your assessment for where the system is falling short today?
You know, we are probably the most comprehensive studier of an existing system. We actually put people out and have been riding the buses. We actually measure wait time. We look at the routing. We look at the deficiencies in the routes. Are they scheduled right or is there a lack of service? We look at the amount of overhead. So, you know, one of the things you get with our company is we've grown from, I guess, 26 million maybe, I don't know, 10 to 15 years ago to over $1 billion in revenue. And it's because of our technology and our self-improvement. You know, in the free market, you have to be best of class in order to continue winning. And then you don't get to stay if you're not delivering a tremendous service. So with us, I guess you would see a much cleaner, a safer, and a lot more service. This is all about the passengers and the citizens here. They want the biggest bang for their taxpayer bucks.
What do you point to as the most comparable experience MV has to MCTS that you bring to the table?
Off the top of my head, Detroit's the exact same size. We were brought in to fix the transit system 3 weeks ago. We're doing a major overhaul. As you know, that city's going through a significant restructuring, exact same size. I think of Orange County, where that was one of our references that I think was called, is that that city, which technically is a not-for-profit itself, the county, is we saved them over $40 million. And instead of pocketing it, they wanted the $40 million of savings plowed right back into additional service because there had been so many cuts. And we found those savings for the citizens. Orange County is a huge – that's 720 buses, I believe, we run there compared to the 400 here. So, you know, I'm thinking of Los Angeles, where we run 600. I've got 800 vehicles in Dallas. I think of New York City. I've got probably 4,000 employees up in New York. So, you know, Milwaukee is a tremendous city to be fortunate enough to try to have them consider us. But I'm optimistic that we can do a terrific job here. And if we don't, you know what, we won't be asked to stay. And it's that simple. From the day we get here, we've got to over-deliver on promises made. And I, you know, I hear a lot of talk about that, but that's important.
You have, in just recent days, sent a number of letters to current employees to reassure them about their pay, their benefits, their seniority, their pension plan. So clearly, you're aware you'd be facing a workforce that views this change with caution or skepticism and in some cases, suspicion. How does that affect how you'd undertake the transition? Why is it so important to be, I guess, proactive in these reassurances?
You know, I guess maybe we're a bit different. Is a lot of people have seen I'm in the city almost every week now. Is you got to be a good listener. And I'll tell you, that is the absolute management secret for me, is that if I'm out in the field listening, what are we hearing? I try to communicate directly with the employees to alleviate their natural fears. This is – look, change management is not easy. And I find this in every city we go into that is looking to take their service levels up significantly. And people are afraid of change. It's a natural human reaction. But what's also natural is to be a good listener as the CEO. And when I hear a specific concern, address it directly, try to respond directly. And, you know, look, I'm used to having incumbents throw everything they can to try to justify why they lost or didn't win or whatever. But I'm going to take the high road here. If we're fortunate enough to have, the county approve us and the supervisors, I would encourage them to ask us a lot of hard questions. But I think they'll find that we're straight up. We have been with our employees. That's what's allowed us to grow. And I'm not going to change that. And I'm going to stay out in the field listening to my drivers and listening to my passengers.
There was a report back in August that many senior-level bus drivers could depart the system if the contract goes through. What is your take on that possibility? Have you seen that happen in other places where MV has taken over?
You know, I heard that in Las Vegas. I heard that in Orange County. I heard that when it took over Dallas. I heard that when it took over Houston. Look, it's natural to throw a lot of stuff out. I heard that a lot in Orange County. I mean, it was just taking on a life of its own. The simple fact is that if you don't do people right, they will leave. And I've tried to reassure everybody. And, you know, if there's a driver out there listening, I'll tell you, I've already gone on the record and you have my word. I need you. Actually, I need you worse than you need me. You may well have options, but I need safe drivers. And this is a very safe network. I just want to improve on that. And we've got some plans that we'll unveil to try to actually share some of the improved efficiency with the drivers. I'm a good listener, and I just showed up at a union hall yesterday in New York because I had heard the drivers wanted to address me directly, and I flew from New York here. That's what I do well, is listen.
What can you tell us about the person who would run the system? This is the gentleman from Green Bay.
Tremendous reputation. We considered about 30 to 40 different candidates. You know, I guess I look at his background. He's perfect. He's made a lot of improvements. Tremendous reputation. I think he's earned the right to go to a bigger system backed by a company that will give him every bit of support he could possibly ask for. But I'm also keen to have local leadership that understands the need. Look, we have a lot of great Midwestern values here. This is, you know, this is the bed of hard work got us where we are. I mean, when I think of cities, Milwaukee stands out. You know, I'm a soft-tail Harley rider and have been since I was 23. This is a tremendous city. And we thought what would best serve is someone that's familiar with the region and would adapt very well. And we want them to stay too. So I'm not big on moving someone in from, you know, across the country or something like that. And I think he's going to be a tremendous asset and has certainly got all of our attention of how he manages himself, references, tremendous references on what he's done with people skills. I think it'd be a perfect fit.
Well, and you mentioned local leadership. There's, of course, an existing staff separate from the bus drivers that's been involved in administering the transit system, some for years. Would you anticipate that all of them, some of them, any of them would be likely retained with the demise of the existing company, MTS?
I'm hoping a lot of them will consider staying. You know, that'll be their option. Look, it's so early on. I haven't done an analysis, and we haven't really talked about that. But the hard facts are I need experienced people in the management team to stay and help us. We'll be doing interviews of them, and I'm hoping a lot of them will consider staying because we certainly need them.
The other aspect to this that has resulted in some concern by some in the media anyway is that the bidding process hasn't played out as publicly as they would like. Are there aspects of the bidding process you'd want to share with us?
You know, we don't even know where we ranked versus the others. And as you can imagine, we're totally at the mercy of any transit agency, city, county that wants to run its bid. And honestly, they all run them differently. This seems to be a case in which they wanted to try to negotiate with us in private on the contract without having stones thrown in from the outside or perhaps a losing bidder saying we were willing to do this and you – You know, all we did was put the best value we could at what we thought we could do with this transit agency. And, you know, that'll kind of be up to them to disclose what they want to. I'm really totally at the mercy of the system on that. All I know is we were asked to come forward and talk with them. And so I'm assuming we scored well. I know it was a very competitive process. I've heard that from other competitors. But we were fortunate enough to at least be at this place where the county supervisors would consider us. And, you know, we need to make our case to the county supervisors. And if we're worthy, perhaps they'll consider us.
And you would be okay if the county chose to disclose whatever they choose to disclose at this point?
Absolutely. We're usually, you know, that's usually what we do face. Look, I'm all about transparency from my company. But every agency likes to run this differently, and many don't even disclose the winner when the city council chambers are over. You find out days later. So there's not a right or wrong. But the way we'll run this is full transparency, okay?
What is it about your background that brings you to this? Why is this what you do?
Well, you know, I guess I've always had a love for transportation. I drove a school bus when I was 16 years old. It's hard to imagine nowadays that you trust a 16-year-old with your children. But back in North Carolina, you know, we would be handpicked. I drove a school bus all through high school. That's how I got money to go to college. And that along with a lot of debt. Later on, I worked my way up through PricewaterhouseCoopers to be the U.S. managing partner of consulting, and then I worked my way up to the global managing partner of government services and infrastructure, which includes transportation. Had a great love for it and was about to retire from Pricewaterhouse, and I got a call from MV saying, we would love for you to come here and bring that expertise from a global knowledge of transports around the world. And bring this to MV. So I'm going on my third year now, and it's rapidly becoming the greatest love in my life next to my wife, if she's listening. She may say work may be sometimes more important in her field. But
well, Carter Pate, thank you so much for taking some time to talk to us, and best of luck to you.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to getting to know Milwaukee even better. Thanks for the time.
Carter Pate is the CEO of Dallas-based MV Transportation, which is in line to take over the contract to run Milwaukee County Transit, pending approval by the County Board of Supervisors. the reality of political town hall meetings circa 2013. We'll get some insight into how at least one elected official is keeping current with constituents when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. There are numerous ways national politicians keep in touch with their constituents. Members of Congress and senators have staffs and offices in their home states and districts, and most meet with constituents who are visiting Washington. For years, local town hall meetings have been another venue enabling people to have access to their elected officials. But an article in the September Milwaukee Magazine describes how politics and technology are changing the town hall dynamic for at least one Wisconsin politician. Writer Larry Sandler is here to explain. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mitch. It's a pleasure to be back here.
We had you on this program last month talking about your article on Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson. And that article actually spawned another article that we're talking about now. What got you thinking about Ron Johnson's the way he keeps in touch with constituents?
Well, in fact, it was when I was working on the other article that Johnson's staff started giving me a lot of information about him, some of which I actually hadn't requested, but they were giving me a lot of background information. And one fact that they gave me was the number of teletown halls that he held. And this was a concept that I actually have to admit I wasn't familiar
with. Right. Teletown halls is not something that has really been on the menu for very long.
No. It's a relatively recent development. It has been around for a few years. We had not heard too much about it in Wisconsin, and it's not something that local politicians make too much of. It seems to be a phenomenon for members of Congress. And the idea of a teletown hall is that instead of having the traditional town hall meeting where people get into a high school gym or auditorium or some other big meeting hall and they all ask their questions or make their comments directly to the congressman or senator, in a teletown hall, it's all done by teleconference. So you either dial in or they dial your number. Then you just chat over the phone, with however many other thousands of people are dialed in at that time.
And there's no guarantee, presumably, that all the people involved in a teletown hall are even from Wisconsin.
No. Theoretically, that is true. Although I suppose, you could say that that's true in an in-person town hall, too, that somebody could just pop in. One difference is that with the regular town halls, the kind that we're used to having in person, there's usually much more in the way of public notice because they want to get people out. And so there might be something in the newspaper or it's publicized in some other way. With the teletown halls, at least the way that Senator Johnson does them, they are publicized basically only through his networks. If you go and see Johnson at some other event, they'll have a sign-up sheet for a teletown hall. But you don't find out about him through the newspaper. There aren't emails sent out about him. They're not posted on his website. This raises kind of a question of accessibility, even though he says that he's more accessible because he can reach more people through these teletown halls. The average person who might have a disagreement with him, who wants to protest, would have to work some to find out about these.
Well, what do we know about how many teletown halls the senator has held?
Well, what he has indicated to me is that there were 22 of him in his first 2 years in office. There's been at least a couple since then. And
there's a chart that accompanies this article, and it says in-person data is not available.
Well, what that indicates, they indicated to me that they don't have any traditional town halls in person, but they didn't give me a clear breakdown of his in-person appearances, how many were open to the public and how many he took questions at. And they said they don't keep that kind of statistics. I get very similar responses from Congressman Ribble's office. A reasonable person can conclude from this that neither Senator Johnson nor Congressman Ribble really hold any traditional in-person town halls. They do all the town halls over the phone, and they have in-person events which aren't really town halls and, don't necessarily meet that definition. So what basically was happening was their press people were telling me about, we do all these other in-person events to sort of distract attention from the fact that they don't really have any town halls.
Well, and lest we think that this is a Republican-Democrat issue, it doesn't necessarily break down that way because in stark contrast to the number of in-person town halls that Congressman Sensenbrenner has held.
Well, that's true. And Congressman Sensenbrenner is just really into this. And for several years now, he has been the leader in the entire U.S. Congress in terms of the number of town halls that he has. And, you know, just in the last term, the 2011-2012 term, he held 235, which is enormous. I mean, it's – I think that's almost as much as everybody else put together in the delegation. And interestingly enough, he doesn't talk too much about that. And I know that Roll Call, which is a newspaper – in Washington, D.C. that's focused on the Congress, had asked him, you know, a couple years ago, and he didn't want to talk about it then. So he's kind of low-key about that. But he is the congressional leader in that score.
Well, now, as you said, the Senator Johnson, and his staff say that the phenomenon of teletown halls allows the senator to be in touch with potentially way more people than a traditional town hall might otherwise. What are the other advantages that people who are holding these teletown halls cite?
That is that's the primary advantage that they cite, that they can reach more people, and also, you know, the people can do this from the comfort of their home rather than coming out. You know, I mean, Senator Feingold used to hold one in each county, but even so, a county is a big place. You got to drive some distance to the county seat or wherever the town hall is being held. Those are the advantages that they talk about. Now, the advantage that they don't talk about is the one that I mentioned previously, where people who want to protest, at least protest very visibly, don't show up. And Senator Johnson says, oh, you know, I always start out with a caller who disagrees with me. And that may be, but it's outside the view of the media. And it is interesting that when Senator Feingold and other Democrats were doing this, and Senator Feingold, by the way, at that time was the Senate leader in town halls because he would hold one in each of Wisconsin's 72 counties. When Democrats were doing this, the Tea Party didn't like it. You go back to 2009, 2010, the Tea Party said, oh, you know, they're trying to hide from us by doing teletown halls, because what was happening at that time was the Tea Party was coming to the Democrats' town halls and making a huge stink about what is now known as Obamacare, you know, about the Affordable Care Act. And a lot of that would get caught on television, and then it would become fodder in the campaigns. Now, Republicans like Senator Johnson have been elected with Tea Party support. And as far as I know, the Tea Party is not making as big a deal about the Republicans holding the teletown halls in apparently significantly greater numbers, you know, based on Roll Call than the Democrats did.
Are there people who are traditionally seen as political opponents of Senator Johnson who are making a big deal about this?
No, not at this time. I don't think this has garnered a lot of attention. You know, as far as I know, this article that appears in the September issue of Milwaukee Magazine is the first time that it's been brought up.
What do we know about how many people are allowed to take part in these teletown halls? How many questions does he typically take? And are these questions vetted before they become a part of the event?
They dial about 40,000 numbers. He says
40,000 numbers per call.
Per call, that's right.
There are 40,000 people that are participating.
Yes. Yeah, at least for part of it. He says that there's 10,000 to 15,000 who hold on for the whole thing. Yeah, they're about an hour long. He takes about 12 to 15 questions. And I don't know to what extent they're screened beforehand. I mean, typically on a conference call, there is some screening that goes on. And in fact, there must be some screening because he says that they open with somebody who wants to criticize them, so they wouldn't know that if they weren't doing some screening in advance.
Larry Sandler, thanks so much.
Thank you, Mitch.
Larry Sandler's article, The Red Phone, on Senator Ron Johnson's teletown hall meetings, is in the September issue of Milwaukee Magazine. You'll find a link from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Another break now, and then the link between poverty levels and the welfare of animals. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. More of Lake Effect now. I'm Mitch Tine. Milwaukee's 53206 zip code has one of the highest poverty rates in the city. And according to the Wisconsin Humane Society, it also has one of the highest rates of stray and impounded animals. Executive Director Ann Reed says that's no coincidence. There is an established link between human poverty and animal welfare. So the WHS is reaching out to the community with a new program called Pets for Life. It offers free spay and neuter surgeries for pets whose owners live in 53206. Reed tells Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce how this community outreach will improve the lives of animals.
It is definitely true that wherever there is human suffering, there is animal suffering. The same kinds of causes and dynamics and forces that challenge our communities where people live also challenge the animals in those communities. And what we've found is, you know, there's so many wonderful organizations, both public and private, focusing on our challenged neighborhoods in so many different ways and really focusing on the experience of people there and especially children. We look at that and we say the right organization to step forward and address the needs of animals there is the Wisconsin Humane Society. And we really hadn't done much in the community types of outreach before. We do a lot of really impactful work at our shelter and try to welcome folks to come there and take advantage of our services. But heading out into the community has been a wonderful and a learning experience for us.
Well, so give us some examples. What are some of the issues you're working on when you're out in these neighborhoods?
The biggest issue that we want to get to is spay-neuter of animals. You know, in your average community with good services for animals in it, you're going to see in this region an average spay-neuter rate, people who have had their animals altered, of between 80 and 90%. In our city's underserved communities, that's going to flip, and it's going to be 80 to 90% unneutered animals. In fact, we're seeing routinely in our work there 90% of animals unneutered. And that, in turn, leads to all kinds of issues relating to overpopulation, to health, to too many animals entering shelters. And so that's what we're really trying to get to ultimately. But what we find is, you know, like so many other things, the way to make change is not to go and shake your finger at somebody and saying you should change. The way to make change is to figure out what's really needed and come in from a point of view of how can we help. And what we've found is that the service levels in Milwaukee's really challenged communities are so low that a lot of what's needed is just plain service.
Well, yeah, I want to have you talk a little bit more about what the barriers are to having animals be spayed and neutered within these specific areas.
Sure. You start with just the availability of the service itself. So we're targeting right now the 53206 zip code in Milwaukee. We've been doing big outreach clinics there right around the intersection of Titonia and Center. So right, that's kind of the center of the area that we're focusing on. In the 53206 zip code, there's not one single veterinarian's office, not one. And then the other kinds of things that are available, you know, where can you buy food affordably? Where can you get information? Where can you buy the appropriate leash or harness for your big dog so that you can handle that dog easily without a big metal collar? Just up and down the line, those kinds of services are not available. So we've gone out now twice, once in April and once in August, and set up just a vaccine clinic, just to start to meet people. In each of those two clinics, we were able to provide free vaccines for over 350 animals each time, more than 700 animals total. People standing in line sometimes for hours to get that vaccine because they love the animal that's in their arms or on the end of that leash, and this is an opportunity that they didn't have before to get that vaccination. That's the kind of thing that we're finding.
Is the issue here just that the services aren't available and that they're not affordable? Are those really the main barriers we're talking about?
Those are the main barriers. And part of what, when you talk about availability, you have to build in transportation. So, for example, at the Wisconsin Humane Society, we've offered free spay-neuter for low-income families for many years. We've offered free food for low-income families for many years. Those are very active programs, each one serving hundreds of people. But when we looked at who was taking advantage of those programs, they weren't from these zip codes because of transportation issues. So what we find is just getting out and building relationships. So the core of the program is people knocking on doors. And it has been so great just getting to know one family and then the family next door and then that person's sister and then the family next door to them and understanding What kinds of things do they need to know about how to care for their animal well? How can we transmit that information and the services? And some of the best calls we get are when, you know, we've only been doing this really since the beginning of this year, so several months, but certainly not years. We've had repeated issues where something important happens in the life of someone we've met there, and they call our outreach person. They call our Jill or they call Lisa just to let them know about something that doesn't even have to do with their animals, but that's the level of relationships that we're building. And then we're definitely seeing it in the statistics already. So we took sort of a snapshot right before our August. We did a clinic in August. Right before then, we had met 800 animals so far, and we knew no one when we started. Of the animals that we had met, only 73 were altered when we met them, which is consistent with the spay-neuter rates that we're normally seeing. Today, of those 800 that we've gotten to know, just about half are neutered already. And I love sometimes just sort of sitting in my office and hearing one of our outreach team on the phone just working on the rest. You know, how about Tuesday? How about the cat? How about the – just starting to talk about how we can make that switch. So what we think about is the power of the fact that you're dealing with folks who live near each other and know each other to help spread it out. And then within that small group, we've really made a big difference, and it helps us picture what it will be like as the program continues to roll out.
You talked before about this idea of it's not effective to go out and wag your finger at somebody saying you're doing this wrong. Mm-hmm. But I wonder if the attitude that owning a pet, caring for an animal, is a privilege one should only take on if you can afford all of those aspects is distracting from those barriers that we talked about.
You know, you've articulated absolutely perfectly what I'm now calling sort of old-style thinking. I mean, as we're placing animals in homes, we think carefully about lots of things about homes, including whether there are the financial resources there to care for that animal in a good way. When you turn to an animal that's already in a home, you can have all the ideas you want about what, quote-unquote, should be happening, but you're not helping that animal with those ideas. What helps that animal is to go out and make friends with the person who loves that animal and give that person what they need to care for the animal well. One of the most convincing things about spay-neuter is not so much if I spay-neuter my animal, I will be contributing to the overall betterment of the animal situation in Milwaukee. It's that spay-neuter prevents certain kinds of cancers and can lengthen the life and the relationship that you have with your animal. That's really powerful. And the fundamental learning here is everybody loves their animal and is looking for ways to love their animal better.
The Wisconsin Humane Society has another program, and this has to do with your Racine location.
We're so excited about this. We acquired the previously separate existing Humane Society in Racine County, the main shelter there, as of January 1 of this year. It's been going great. We've been able to more than double the number of adoptions that are happening in that shelter. But to do the work at the level that we want to do it, we have to have a bigger budget than the shelter did before. And we are almost entirely, our whole organization is almost entirely privately funded. So the Sam and Jean Johnson Community Fund based in Racine has offered to match in the month of September every donation directed to our Racine campus up to a total of $75,000 for this month of September. So it will enable us just to keep marching toward the kind of results that we hoped we would see and are now being able to achieve in Racine County.
Well, Anne Reed, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Anne Reed is Executive Director of the Wisconsin Humane Society. She spoke with Stephanie Lecce about its Pets for Life program, currently offering free spay and neuter surgeries in the 53206 zip code. The Wisconsin Humane Society's Racine campus will also receive a match donation for any gift given during the month of September. The Milwaukee area's colleges and universities draw students from around the country, and increasingly, they're attracting students from around the world. The students are here to take advantage of the strong academic programs, but they're also learning to immerse themselves in American life. Marquette University has created a program to ensure international students are exposed to more than just American classrooms. The International Friendship Program pairs students with Milwaukee area people and families. Erin Lemoyne, who directs the program, and community friend Melody Baker are with us now, along with two Marquette students from China, Xiaofei Song and Wonjun Fan. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
So it's probably a good thing that students are wrapped up in campus life. I mean, that's one of the reasons that they come to a college campus. But what would you say students are missing by not being more involved in community life?
Yeah, our students, since they're not living with host families, kind of miss that family aspect on campus. They're very much with their peers and with their own cohort. So the International Friendship Program gives them an opportunity to really connect with family members in the community and, you know, go to a soccer game or go enjoy a Thanksgiving dinner with a family. So it just gives them a different look at U.S. culture.
Why did you sign on when this friendship program came about 6+ years ago?
I have a real interest in getting to know people from other countries. It's just a personal interest of mine, and learning about other cultures, and I like to travel, so that's a good way to do that. I find that pretty much all the international students I've made friends with have invited me to come and visit them in their countries.
Have you had a chance to do that?
Not any of the students yet. Yeah, I have visited other people that I've met.
Well, and let me ask the two of you this. Why was this an important part of what you wanted to be involved with at Marquette?
Because when we just came here, we are like international students. We do not have any relationship involved in the U.S. And when we have a host, like our high school students, they have a host family. They can get into the United States family culture in high school. But we just came here in the undergraduate student. So like we get a chance to know how the American family live and how they spend their rest of time. So it's kind of like a good opportunity for us to really understand how the American culture.
Well, and so this is the idea that when you go back to China, you would bring back more than just your education?
Yeah, actually, my family, they just go back to China and for 1 month and meet my friend.
Oh, that's neat.
Yeah.
And how about you? What have you gotten out of what's been important to you?
Like this is a good opportunity to practice the speaking and listening skill, and also I have the chance to know a lot of American culture.
Aaron Lemoine, what is the commitment that someone who joins the program as an international friend has to make?
All of our community friends attend an orientation session where we just kind of set up the expectations for the program. And then we hold a kickoff event where they actually get to meet their student for the first time. And so that's just a time for them to bond and get to know each other in a nice, safe space. And then from there, it's really up to the pair to make what they want to out of the program. We recommend that they get together with their students once a month. And we also really encourage our families to include their students in things that they're already doing. So if they go to the plays at the rep every month, you know, invite the student to join them. Or if they're kids in soccer, to go to a soccer game with them, things of that nature.
So how do you go about setting up the right match? Or is there a right match?
We try and gather some basic information about students' hobbies and interests and likewise the family members' hobbies and interests and try and kind of balance it that way. Also based on, for example, if a student is studying business and perhaps the individual is a business person working at a bank, we might be able to connect them that way so that there's some common ground.
You suggest that they set up a time at least once a month. Do you find that the participants are doing it more often than that?
Some of them, absolutely. Some of them may see each other every week. So it really varies on everyone's schedule.
What are the kinds of things that you have done as a friend in this program?
I've done a variety of things, and I like to include them in a lot of my family activities. One of the things the students have told me is most meaningful to them is just being able to come to an American home and have a meal. So pretty simple. But other things we've done have been experiencing a Milwaukee fish fry, going to the zoo, the Pabst Mansion, the North Point Lighthouse, you know, some of the Milwaukee sites we've seen. And then also some sporting events, Summerfest. A couple years ago, there was the Chinese New Year celebration at the Domes. I went to that with one of my students. That was a lot of fun.
What are some of the most enjoyable experiences the two of you have had as part of this?
Last summer, we went to the Summerfest. Yeah, we listened to a lot of bands. They play music, and at the end, there's a firework.
I spent my last year Thanksgiving Day with the host family, their family, and they treat me like a family member. And like we drink turkey and dumplings together, and we see a soccer game and play with dogs. And then they tell me that next time they will bring me to hunting. That totally I will not experiment in China like that. So it's unforgettable, yeah.
How great is the need right now?
We typically have around between 30 to 50 matches each year, depending. But this year, we actually have the largest incoming group of new international students. So we actually have 159 undergraduate and graduate students. Now, this program is something that we open up to them on an interest-based. So it depends on how many applications we get in from the students each year. But we're always looking. We always have more students than we have volunteers and family members.
Well, thank you to all four of you, and best of luck through the next year.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Erin Lemoine is International Marketing and Communications Coordinator at Marquette University's Office of International Education, which runs the International Friendship Program. Melody Baker is a community friend, and Jovei Song and Wong Jun Fan are international students from China. There's a link to more about the program at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. The application deadline to participate this school year is Friday. 134 buildings around Milwaukee will open their doors this weekend. We'll get a preview of the third Doors Open Milwaukee when Lake Effect continues on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Some of Milwaukee's best-known buildings and some lesser-known places will welcome visitors this weekend. Doors Open Milwaukee has grown to include 134 buildings in its third year. Amy Graw is Doors Open Milwaukee program manager. She says the event is also trying to expand its footprint.
We've kind of grouped up with a Healthy Neighborhoods Initiative, who represents various neighborhoods outlying the downtown Milwaukee area. And they have come and brought us a lot of different new sites for Doors Open. So we're excited to be able to broaden our scope of what we've normally done in the past.
What do you see those places as getting out of this? And in fact, even the places that have been a part of Doors Open in the past, what are they getting out of throwing their doors open for a day or two?
It's a community event that kind of brings all of Milwaukee together. It also promotes their specific site. It makes people aware that it even exists. There's a lot of places on Doors Open this year, a lot of new sites that people don't even know are there. There's some bigger buildings that haven't participated that should be noted, like the Gaslight Building, certain places downtown that haven't been part of Doors Open that people have skipped by in previous years. The Wells Building has never participated. Those are just right in the downtown area. The idea of Doors Open, in my perspective, is to open every door in Milwaukee. So, yes, we're growing from 100 to 120 to 130. I would love to keep growing, adding the new sites to the old, because the people that haven't been to them the last 2 years are able to participate in those. So they never really get old. With 134 sites, there is no way that a person can visit every site.
Well, and what do you think the lingering effect is? I mean, there's obviously an idea behind having those doors open on that day or two in September. But what about the other 363 or 364 days?
Like I said prior, though, I think it brings the community together, the businesses together. I think it's lingering not only for the fact that people are aware of the community as a whole throughout the entire year, but also that the businesses themselves get together.
How much work do you do with each of the buildings to help shape the visitor experience during Doors Open?
We start this in January all the way. So this has been going on since January to acquire, you know, the sites and buildings that are going to participate. And they're asked to contribute to explaining what a visitor experience would be for each. And then we can tweak them from there. I mean, if it's something that you're just going in and walking in the front door and not seeing anything, we ask that you give a little more, because Sometimes it is just people walking in the front door. They have not. The federal courthouse is a great example for that. You're not really allowed in the federal courthouse. But in Doors Open, you're allowed not only in the federal courthouse. You can take the tour. There's an exterior tour. There's an interior tour. There's all these different ways that people can. So we ask to give as specific as a description as possible. And then we put that on the website. And then for the event guide that's actually printed, we condense it to specifically talk about the visitor experience over the history and the architecture of the building.
How common is it for these buildings to have somebody on staff, on hand, who knows a lot about the building itself that they feel comfortable giving a tour?
Shockingly, pretty good. For Doors Open Milwaukee, we have about 400 volunteers that participate and help out throughout the event. So those people are there to help with crowd control and help with giving Doors Open information. But there's always going to be someone, at least one person, if not two or 12 or 25, depending on the site, that are knowledgeable about the area. And some people really just want to get in and really don't want to know too much about it. They just want to see it. And then there's some people who want to know specifically when it was built, who it was built by, how long it took. There's a big broad scope of the people that attend Doors Open.
As the person who's coordinating this whole event, have you gotten to look inside each and every one of these 134?
No, I wish. People assume I do.
Yeah, I would have assumed.
Right, I would love
to. You don't have to go
on site
visits.
There's no time. Right. Well, born and raised in Milwaukee, I know a lot about a lot of these sites, but there's quite a few that are new to me. So yes, I did tour quite a few of them, but not all of them.
If people only had a limited amount of time and a limited chance to get around, you wouldn't want to, throw out any of the other ones, but what's the can't-miss event for you?
The U.S. Bank Building, which has participated in all 3 years, is probably one of the best views of Milwaukee. You get to go all the way up to the U.S. Bank, where the sign is up at the top, and check out the entire city from every angle. It's a magnificent view. The Gaslight Building is new this year, and you get to go up to the 17th floor observation deck and check out the view there, which would be wonderful.
And the nice thing is they're essentially across the street from each other.
They really are. And Northwestern Mutual is right there. The Wells Building's right there. Marriott, which is new this year, the Marriott downtown, is also participating. There's another really great hub right in that area. Personally, I would try to delve out a little bit. Sherman Park has this wonderful site, Schrager Auction Galleries, which has this incredible dome, which is only second in Wisconsin to the Madison Capitol. And you would never be able to see this from the street.
You have absolutely piqued my interest. Amy Graw, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Amy Graw is program manager for Doors Open Milwaukee. This weekend's event is organized by Historic Milwaukee and includes 134 buildings around the city. You'll find a link to much more information from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Finally today, we're listening to some in-studio music performances this week on Lake Effect. Singer-songwriter John Grant is originally from Michigan, but now lives in Iceland. Given his interest in and propensity for learning languages, it's no surprise that his most recent album, Pale Green Ghosts, is driven as much by wordplay as the keyboards that fill its sound. We'll hear an interview with Grant in the coming days, but today we'll listen in on one of the songs he played for us, called GMF.
Half of the time I think I'm in some movie. I play the underdog, of course. Dig up Richard Burton's corpse. I am not who you think I am. I am quite angry, which I barely can conceive. You think I hate myself, but it's you I hate. Because you have the nerve to make me feel. But I am the greatest living creature you are ever gonna meet. From the top of my head down to the tips of the toes on my feet. So go ahead and love me 5% more of the time. You could be laughing 65% more of the time. I should have practiced my scales. I should not be attracted to males. But you said that I should learn to love myself. Make up your mind, Dr. Frankenstein.
John Grant playing GMF in the Lake Effect Performance Studio before a recent concert at Turner Hall. We'll hear the full interview with him in the days to come. That's Wednesday's show. Tomorrow, another in-studio performance, a much different one, from Zoe Muth and the Lost High Rollers. I'm Mitch Teich. So great to have you listening today, and I sure hope you'll be with us tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Fresh Air is next. Stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock.
So go ahead and love me while it's still a crime. Don't forget, could be laughing 65% more of the time. 'Cause I am the greatest living creature you are ever gonna meet. From the top of my head down to the tips of the toes on my feet. So go ahead.